Welcome to the 2024 series of the Words and Nerds podcast. I'm Danny B, author, publisher, and your podcast host. With over 1 million plays, thanks to you, listeners, readers, writers, creatives, teachers, librarians, and book lovers, thank you for coming along for the journey where we bring you relaxed and real conversations about writing and creativity. If you love an episode, you can leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram or Facebook at Danny V Words Nerds Podcast. Or you can check out my brand new website designed by Gin & Co at dannyv.com.au.
Hello everyone, welcome to Words and Nerds, the podcast that brings literary goodness to your ears. I'm author Adrian Beck, sitting in for Danny V, who's taking a short break. Now on this episode, we're joined by one of WA's finest book creators, Gabriel Evans. It's an absolute thrill to have him with us. Gabriel is a children's book author and an illustrator who works primarily in watercolour and pencil, creating books from a small studio on a big hill. Gabriel's books are published internationally in more than 12 countries. They've been reviewed in the New York Times, translated into 10 languages and counting, and they've been read on ABC's Play School. I wonder if Big Ted was involved in that. I'll have to find out. Blue Flower by Sonia Hartnett, his first picture book with Penguin Random House, was shortlisted for the CBCA Picture Book of the Year in 2022. And his second picture book with Penguin, A Friend for George, was published in 2023, followed by Listen Hippo, released on the day of recording today. Listen Hippo has just come out. Welcome and congratulations. Welcome to Words and Nerds, Gabriel Evans.
Thank you, Adrian. It's lovely to finally be on Words and Nerds.
How does it feel to have the book out today?
Oh, man, it means a lot, this book. This book is particularly special. So, yeah, really excited to have it out today. It's been a long time in the making, this one. And in fact, this book was created over the time that we had our little boy. So many sleepless nights followed by days trying to illustrate this book. It's been a long time in the making.
I'm going to get to the bottom of that. That sounds like an intriguing process. But what I would like to ask first up is, on the day of publication, do you have a routine? Like, is there something you'll be doing? Will you be wandering to your favorite bookshop to see if you can spot it in the wild? Or what do you do to celebrate on the day of your publication?
To be honest, if I lived near a bookshop, I would probably be straight down there. So I live in a small country town. We don't have a bookshop.
You don't have a bookshop.
So I tend to celebrate through social media, going online, seeing other people celebrate it too, other bookshops sharing it. And it's very much of a virtual celebration. But we're heading to Sydney in about a week's time. So then we're having a delayed celebration in bookshops. So next week, we're just going to be visiting bookshops, catching up with all the children's booksellers and celebrating it then.
Great stuff. Hopefully you'll have like a family dinner or something, like a toast to the book or something like that today. Is that on the cards?
Absolutely. an extra shot in my coffee.
I like it. That'll make it 6 shots probably. All right. Now, Gabriel, for those that haven't had a chance to check it out just yet, I know it's just come out, so maybe there's a few that haven't. Could you give us a little intro? What is Listen Hippo all about?
Yeah, so Listen Hippo is a story about listening. So it starts off with this little boy called Billy, who is feeling sad. And we never delve into why he's sad. He's feeling sad, and then his friend, the hippo, comes in and spends a lot of the book trying to cheer Billy up. But the one thing that Billy wants, Hippo isn't giving him, and that's his time, his ear, just to sit and listen to why Billy is feeling sad. So it really is a story about listening to someone when they're feeling a little sad or a little confused, rather than just trying to cheer them up, putting a bandage on their sadness.
Mm. I am guilty of that. In fact, my wife has has claimed that I could perhaps do a little bit more listening and a little less fixing. I wonder where did this sort of come from, Gabriel?
Well, you know what? I'm the same. I think I'm a little bit of a hippo. And but also I've been a Billy as well. There's one conversation that really stands out from a couple of years ago, where I was just a little overwhelmed. We were building a house at the time, and I was overwhelmed by the process. And I was talking to a friend, and they were trying to come up with ways for me to cope with feeling overwhelmed, and I was kind of like, this is what you're saying is correct, but right now I just need to vent. I need to talk about the frustration, the concern. So that kind of really stuck with me, that conversation. But also, I am a hippo, and I do tend to want to help people if they've got a problem. And it really is often just about listening, you know, making a cup of tea, having a coffee with someone, and just sitting with them and hearing them out. So I'm a little bit of a hippo, and I've just got to realize that and work through that.
That's right. We've all got to curb our hippo tendencies.
I know. It was almost a therapy session making this book.
It sounds like it. Now, we talked about social media just before. Very, very exciting. I've seen it popping up in the last few days, because sometimes bookshops, they get an early release and they get their hands on it a little earlier and they start getting very excited. And one such bookshop that is super excited, and it's wonderful to see, is one of my absolute favourites. One of the best booksellers in the whole country, Rachel Robson from Glee Books. I don't know if you've seen this yet, but a quote from her when she was giving you a review was, "Congratulations, Gabriel. This is your finest book yet and a strong contender for our favourite for the year. We absolutely adore it, shining brightly in our favourite section and in the window." How good is that?
Wow. Wow. That means a lot, especially from Rachel, who is an absolutely dynamic, amazing children's bookseller and someone who sees a lot of books. So, and you know, I mean, I know you as an author, you'd get this, where you spend so much time with this book, it's there's always that kind of vulnerability when you put it out. So to get people in the book industry saying things like that means a lot. It really does.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. There's a degree of you know, you're so excited on the day of release, but there's a degree of trepidation as well, that's for sure.
Oh, amazingly so. Amazingly so. And I mean, especially for this book, because it feels so much more personal, you know. So, you know, I'm not saying other books, there's no connection there, but, you know, when you really put something about yourself in there, you really want to, you want people to like it. You want that, validation for sure.
Absolutely. So it's a personal topic. I mean, it's, you know, there's a little bit of one of the characters, obviously, is dealing with sadness, and our hippo friend is trying to help as best he can. Why exactly did you want to tackle that issue? Sometimes we need different sorts of things from our loved ones, depending on the circumstances. In this case, it sounds like little Billy just wanted to be heard. But why did you want to tackle that as a topic? You know, you've got to spend, you spend hours and days and months and sometimes years with a picture book. So it's got to be something that really hits home. So why did you want to tackle that?
Yeah, look, when I'm creating a book, I never sit down with a topic in mind. I've tried making lists of topics to look into, and that's never worked for me. I always have to find the story, find the topic through a really time-consuming meander in my sketchbook. So I will spend days trying to find characters and find their stories, and I'm not going to say waste pages, but I'll spend pages creating these ideas that never go anywhere. And for Listen Hippo, that story came about when I just drew this hippo, and he was just this big, energetic character. And then next to him was this little quiet boy who wanted to say something. and the hippo was just far too busy to listen, but not in a malicious way. You know, the hippo was obviously a very friendly character. And then I just started delving into this relationship and this idea of listening. And it very much came about from an organic way. And then as I spent more time with it, I began to find my footing with what I was wanting to say with the idea of listening. And yeah, there is something personal there where, you know, where sometimes you're the hippo or sometimes you're Billy. So, and I think that's important when you can find a topic that you actually relate to in a book. But yes, I never set about to pursue a topic. It's something that finds its way. It's almost like there's a story there, and then the story, sort of the enjoyment of that story, is bubbling away, and maybe the topic emerges. I don't know. To be honest, I've never really sat down and tried to work out my process, because as soon as I do that, I'm worried that process will stop functioning for me.
Yes. Yeah. You don't want the magician's tricks to be revealed. That's for sure. So sounds like you got lots and lots of notebooks of just sketches and ideas and moments that occur to you. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah. So I carry, they're quite small sketchbooks. So they're very kind of portable. And when I'm, you know, waiting at an airport, when I'm in a cafe, sitting in my studio, I tend to just carry these sketchbooks around with me and just fill them with little characters, little ideas, putting characters in situations. And, you know, most of these stories will never see the light of day, but sometimes they're just fascinating little concepts, like what happens if you caught the wind in a jar? You know, what does that mean? Can you control the world? Can you control something because you have contained the wind in a jar? There's probably a story there. I haven't found that story, but for me, it's just an entertaining concept, and it just sits in my sketchbook. And sometimes just pandering to those interesting ideas paves the way for something else to emerge. So yeah.
Now, without wanting to ruin the process for you, I do want to risk it and ask the question: Do your ideas usually start from a sketch, or does the sketch lead to the concept, and then you work on the concept a little? What I'm trying to get at is, author illustrators are led by the visuals, or sometimes they're led by the concept. But do you have one or the other that pulls you in a certain direction, or are you about 50-50?
No, I came into the industry as an illustrator. So for quite a few years, I was illustrating for other people. My first picture book that I wrote and illustrated was 2019. And so in many ways, as an author illustrator of picture books, I'm relatively new still. So I am a really visual thinker and a visual developer. So although what I tend to do in my sketchbook is I'll be drawing situations, drawing ideas, and then accompanying it with written words underneath, with a bit of text. And often that the dialogue ends up kind of making its way over into the story, and some of the best sentences, the best lines happened in my sketchbook. So when I present my work to my publisher, I never present a manuscript. It's always a storyboard. Just because for me, the story only works with the text and the visuals together in my mind. I have to show them. And the negative, the downside of that is, by creating a storyboard to show them rather than just a manuscript, it takes so much longer to develop. And sometimes the publisher just says no. You know, I'll send it to a couple of my publishers and they just go, look, we don't think it's working. And that we put that story aside. Well, sometimes I've created a whole book and then realize it's just not functioning as a story. But the only way I can get there is by storyboarding the entire thing. So it's a very time-consuming process, but it's the way that I create, because the words and the pictures, they both come together at the same time.
Leads to some stunning results, though, as well. And you talked about some of those sentences that just they might emerge from the images and all that sort of stuff. A sentence that I just, when I read it, I thought, oh, that's exquisite. That sentence is later in the book. It says, Billy talked about the midnight he felt in his tummy, and that is just a stunning line, and accompanied by just a breathtaking double page spread of the two characters looking up at this at the midnight sky. When I saw that, I thought this is unbelievable. I don't really have a question there, Gabe. I just thought that was a wonderful moment.
Well, I'll just add to that some of those specifically the areas where Billy is describing how he feels, all those sentences, those images actually predate the book and were ideas that I'd played with earlier. So when he feels midnight in his tummy, that actually comes from a sketchbook illustration I created maybe 2-3 years ago, where there is a boy who is the outline of a boy, and then his tummy is just midnight, and the midnight is then gushing out of his tummy into the sketchbook. And it was just a picture I drew. I wasn't feeling sad at the time. It was more of this poetic concept that came into my mind. So yeah, for me, the sketchbook is this place where, yes, I ponder these ideas, these concepts, and then I will use them for the right book down the track. And the autumn leaves and winter trees was another line taken from another story idea that I'd been playing with a couple of years ago. So the sketchbook for me is very much, it's almost like it's taking my brain and it's making a record of what's happening in my brain, and I'm able to come back to it later on. So on my table, my work table, I have just this big line of sketchbooks, all dated. I try and date every single sketchbook from when I started to when I finished, and they're just sitting there, and I pull them out at random sometimes, especially if I'm just feeling a little lost for ideas, and I can just revisit some of these concepts, these meanderings, these thoughts.
I love it. It's such an interesting process, but such a creative and organic, and it's just, yeah, it's a, it makes me want to create a notebook rather than just be Instagramming all day. You know what I mean?
I do a bit of that too.
Yeah, of course. Who doesn't? Well, look, I mean, we're talking about notebooks and the illustrations, etc. And obviously, just by looking at, I mean, the whimsy, the childlike whimsy in these books that you create is just, it's second to none. It's superb. I love it. I just, and the magic carpet rides over the bustling cities and all, our kids are going to absolutely lap up those images. They're going to love that stuff. So I look at your work, and we're talking about you and the notebooks. It's obviously very practical. Is it fair to say you don't use much digital, you don't use an iPad to do your creating and all that sort of thing? Is that a deliberate decision to be very practical with your art?
Yeah, look, I came into illustration as someone that loved traditional mediums like watercolor, gouache, pencil. When I was 19, I went to Tasmania and spent a couple of weeks with this watercolorist who's quite internationally acclaimed, and he was running a watercolor course, and he sort of invited me along just to sit there with the other paying people and just be almost like lap it in paint. And that was very important for me to take on a more, bring a lot more emotion from the paint into my work. So I've always had this real love of watercolor. And I do occasionally create digital art for magazines, etc. And I enjoy the process. And I think if I spent more time with digital, I could definitely, I think I would really get something out of it. but I don't quite get lost in the digital work like I get lost in traditional mediums. There's something so organic. There's a risk there as well. It's always funny if I've been doing a little bit of digital work and then I start working on some watercolor and I make a mistake. There's this thing in my mind that I can just go back a couple of steps or delete that layer, and then you can't. And there's times when publishers will want changes, and it's always so much more of an effort in traditional. But at the end of it, there's something that I think I can get more of a convey a little bit more emotion, a little bit more honesty in traditional work, which I can't quite do with digital. And I really admire, there's so many digital artists out there that can do that. And I'm so envious. But yeah. I just love
But they're really trying to imitate the practical art, really.
Yeah.
That's what they're so if really what they're trying to do is do what you do so well in some ways. I don't know, I just this feels like there's something more human about seeing the genuine brushstrokes on the page, you know what I mean?
Yes. And knowing I always try and push myself. In every book, there's always this element where there's a massive risk. So whether it's the midnight sky in Billy's description page, or in other books, whether it's a cloudscape, there's always a point where I want to take a risk, because the energy that I put into taking that risk carries through to the painting. And I want people to take that energy when they read the book. I want them to look at it and know this could have gone horribly wrong. So a book I did with Sonia Hunnett, Blue Flower, the front cover was a picture that took about 12 attempts to get right. So that, to describe the cover, there's this, the young character in the book is painting and making these paint marks over the page, and these paint marks are kind of, there's energy in them, there's this looseness of line. And it took me, yes, I think it was 12 attempts, and bearing in mind how expensive watercolor paper is, I racked up probably $80-$100 worth of paper just to try and get this picture right. But when it worked, I really feel it worked.
It's all worth it. Yeah. Speaking of taking a risk, you mentioned earlier that this Listen Hippo was was created largely when the bub was pretty young, and the sleep deprivation probably kicked in here and there. Do you think that affected the end result somehow, or how did that play out in a practical sense? And would you ever do that again?
I don't know whether I'll have a choice. We set a schedule and then things happen. So Listen Hippo, I was madly trying to finish Listen Hippo before our son came along. And, things happened, book week or book month, book term, gets in slows everything down. So suddenly you're behind schedule a little bit. Anyway, the way that played out was, Arthur was born and I was starting to create the final illustrations within weeks of after his birth. And I would be curious how I would have created that book if I wasn't sleep deprived. I'm really happy with how it turned out. I think it would be relatively similar. I think the difference would be I probably would have created it a little bit faster. So I try to be very hands-on with Arthur, still am. And so you get these pockets of time to work on the book. So that meant that I would come in and I would have to get into the zone and create the work in the time that I had. So it became very time precious making this story. But I would like to think it added something to it. you're very, you're, I mean, you, you, you've got kids, so you'd know. Yes. You're very much on a, a different plane, a different somewhere else in those first few months.
Yes, yes, you are. In fact, in some ways, it's almost like a lucid state. It might have actually helped you get in the zone, perhaps.
To be honest, I reckon so. I reckon probably the page that best reflected how I was feeling would have been Billy's description of the autumn leaves and winter trees. That page was actually really one of my favorite to create because I felt tired. And I think in a way that illustration feels a little tired.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it definitely does. It definitely does. But, absolutely. Yeah. You want to capture all these moods and states of mind on the page. And if you're already in that state of mind, then I'm sure that's got to help, doesn't it?
I think so. But I don't know if I want to do another book in the first few months of a baby. I think next time I need to plan out my schedule a lot better.
Yes. Well, we'll leave that to you. Now, it all began that, like, we're talking about all these beautiful watercolors and practical arts and all that sort of stuff. But I was doing a little reading and I found out that you started kind of as one of those, back in your teenage years, you started like doing cartooning and things like that is the school newspaper? Is that what you're doing it for? Is that where it all sort of, we can track it all back to there, Gabriel?
Yeah, so I was 12 when I was like, you know what? I think I want to be an illustrator. Wow. And I even was quite, I was trying to be sensible at the time, thinking, okay, I want to be an author illustrator, but I know it's really hard to be an author. So I think I want to start off being an illustrator. And
it's a lot of insight for a 12-year-old.
Yes. I'd just been researching a whole bunch of different authors and illustrators and just reading about the slush pile and getting a little terrified of that. And so when I turned 14, I decided to be a cartoonist. And the newspaper was released by the West Australian newspaper, they had a branch in the Southwest, who decided to release a youth newspaper that would go around to all the universities, colleges and schools in the area. And I approached them and said, hey, can I be a cartoonist? And so I did cartooning for free. And then about a year in, I said, can I have a pay rise? And they were like, oh, okay. So they took it to the senior editor and they came back and said, we can give you $20 a cartoon. And I was like, okay, you know. And so I took this pay rise from zero to $20 and then did it for another year, I think, maybe 2 years. And then I quit. And I found it quite stressful because often the editor would forget she had a cartoonist until I would email her to remind her. And then she would send me a list of stories and say, okay, these are the stories featuring, we need a cartoon by the end of working day tomorrow. And then I would go, okay, no worries. And then I'd come up with a couple of ideas and send them through. She would approve one. And then I would take it to a cartoon, final cartoon. And it was all pen and ink and watercolor. So I was learning how to scan my cartoons and get them in the right format to send through for printing. So it was a great learning experience, but I found it a lot of work just for it to appear in a newspaper and then disappear.
Mm.
So I ended up quitting and then working towards being an illustrator. But it was a fantastic, fantastic learning experience.
Absolutely. Was it kind of like those cartoons you see in all the mainstream newspapers that, you know, the news of the day, and you have to do a funny take on some of the events that, yeah, is that it?
Yeah, exactly. And the difference was that it wasn't a political take. Well, a couple of times it was, but 9 times out of 10, it'd be like a school ball was happening. So, okay, I'll do a cartoon on school balls. And at the time, a couple of years, or about a year before I became the cartoonist, I won this trip to go and meet the cartoonist, the editorial cartoonist at the West Australian called Dean Alston, who'd been around for 20, 30 years. He's still the cartoonist there, I believe. And I remember telling him, oh, I want to be a cartoonist. And he just took this time to take me through his process. And I just thought, man, this would be fantastic. And I had old books on Rigby, who was a cartoonist way back in like the 50s. And so for a time there, I thought, oh, maybe an editorial cartoonist is the way I want to go. But I'm just not that on top of politics.
That's probably a good thing, because it can get you down, the old politics at times.
Ooh, and picture books can be a lot less controversial too.
Absolutely.
So it's a safer world to be in.
I love it how you got some advice from another WA creator of sorts. And what I love watching from afar, I'm in Melbourne, but I love seeing all the social medias. The WA book creating scene looks like it's pumping. It looks like it's thriving. I imagine you're all kind of gathering together and sharing tips and helping each other and helping the newcomers and all that sort of stuff. Is that what it's like in reality? That's what it looks like from afar.
Look, the WA crowd are a really supportive crowd. Now, I don't get to hang out with them as much as I want. I'm 3 hours south of Perth.
Yeah.
So I only catch up with them at festivals, or if there's a book catch up event and I happen to be in Perth. And it's a great crowd to hang out with, because, yeah, there's everyone. What I think is really fascinating is, like, for instance, all the author illustrators, everyone creates so differently.
Mm.
And everyone is creating their, everyone seems to have found their niche. And I really love that. And everyone has their different, I mean, you've got the war stories, and then you've got your success stories. And then, yes, you have the newcomers coming in, and you try and take that time to catch up for a cuppa. If someone reaches out, you know, you try and make that time to catch up, because, you know, there was a time when I was emailing an author or an illustrator seeing if they would catch up and take that time to sit. I mean, I remember years ago at a festival sitting with Bruce Watley and just having a bit of a chat with him, and that, I mean, he's so generous with his time.
Mm.
And so you want to give back to the new crowd coming in. But I've also found my wife is a Sydney girl. And so we've spent time living in Sydney on and off. In fact, we were in Sydney over COVID 2020 to 21. And the crowd over there, equally nice. There's something about the book, the children's book world, the kid book world, they're just genuine people. Mm. And same with the publishers. And I'm sure you found this. The publishers are the biggest book nerds. And it's just fantastic to hang out with these people and just have a coffee, have a chat, and just talk shop.
Mm.
So, yeah, the WA crowd are great, but I've found any state I've gone into, the book world, they're just nice people.
Mm. Yeah, I think it attracts, fortunately, I think it attracts a certain type, and most people are very generous with their time and with their help and advice. So it is lovely to see. Speaking of which, I mean, you could invite this next big fan of yours over to WA at some stage to check out how you go about it. I believe King Charles himself. I'm just hearing he's a massive fan of your work, Gabriel. I don't know why you seem to be laughing, but I'm hearing that he is a huge fan. Is this true or false? Have you been to the palace? Has he got any of your artwork hanging up in one of his, you know, 50 million bedrooms? Or
I would like to think he's got some of my art hanging in his boudoir. yeah. So yeah, look, years ago, When he was Prince Charles, he did a trip to Western Australia, and I just got a photo sent to me from one of the city libraries. It was the Albany City of Library down in the Great Southern, down the very bottom of WA, and they presented him with one of my books. And so they just got this photo of him just being presented with this book, and It was kind of cool. So yeah. I'd like to think he probably read it to Camilla on the way home on his trip back to, I'm going to not do an accent, on a trip back to the UK, probably reads it to his grandkids.
I do love Listen Hippo. That's one of my absolute favorites.
Because you see, it's a hippo, but it actually talks. That was a cool little, just a fun little thing. And annoyingly, I've lost the photo. I can't find the photo. So now it's just it's just become a fable.
That's it. Well, I like to believe that he's got many of your books on a bookshelf somewhere, a gold-plated bookshelf somewhere in Buckingham Palace as we speak.
First editions, that's it.
That's right, yes, exactly. Well, we need to let you get back to creating more of these wonderful books. But I guess I should ask, Listen, Hippo's just come out. This is probably a bit premature, but do you have sort of a few things you're working on for the future? What can we look forward to? Is there more in the pipeline?
Yes, so I am working on two books at the moment. So these two books have been bubbling in the background for a little while, and I'm working on the final art for both of those books. And they both come out next year. So yes, this week has just been I'm madly trying to get as much color illustration finished on one of the books before we head off to Sydney for a little bit. But yeah, always busy.
Yeah, it's nothing like a bit of a deadline to help you focus.
I am a sucker for deadlines. I'm a sucker for feedback, for deadlines. There's something about having that structure. Really, really works for me.
Yeah, I'm the same. The worst thing that a publisher can say is, you know what, we're going to push this back by a month, so you've got another month to do it. And you're like, right, feet up on the desk. Where's the pina coladas? Let's relax, you know?
I know. And then you lose that momentum. You need your publisher to be constantly whipping you.
That's it.
Yeah,
I'm all about the stick, not the carrot, I think. So,
100%.
We might have that in common. Look, thanks for joining Words and Nerds today, Gabriel. It's an absolute honour to have you on board with this brilliant new book, Listen, Hippo. Congrats on it coming out today. Very, very exciting. By the time this drops, it'll be out a few days, of course, and everyone will have checked out, I'm sure. But we do hope it makes it into the hands of many, many kids. Congratulations, Gabriel, and good luck with Listen, Hippo.
Thank you, Adrian. It's been an absolute pleasure coming on Words and Nerds and talking about it. It's been fun.
Thanks, Gabriel.